Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Censored, the podcast that's about all kinds of sex in all kinds of art. I'm Aoife Vrednach, a historian with a one-tracked mind. If you do like the podcast, please subscribe, share and review. There are links in the show notes to merch as well, if you fancy it. This time, I'm leaving fiction and non-fiction works behind to turn towards visual art. Not the films, because they were formally censored by the state in the same way as the publications. This episode, I'm exploring how visual works were censured in unofficial, backdoor kind of ways. There was never a censorship office where paintings were scrutinized for filth, but visual art was vulnerable to social and political censure. Now, obviously, I can't read out the rude bits, but please check the show notes for links to the featured images. I've chosen two works this time. The first is by a favourite artist of mine, Harry Clark. A genius with stained glass, his Geneva window was created between 1926 and 1930. I do love Clark, his rich colour palette and then his unforgettable fey melancholy figures, and I have a bit of a thing about stained glass anyway. And the second work is George Rouault's Christ and the Soldier, painted in 1930. It was presented to the Dublin Municipal Gallery of Modern Art in 1942. These very different works of art upset influential people who tried to keep them from the public. How these two pieces were received and what happened to them are stories of censure, secrecy and occasional controversy. To work out what happened, I'm joined by Roisin Kennedy from University College Dublin, who has written a really wonderful book called Art and the Nation State, The Reception of Modern Art in Ireland. Hi Roisin, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Hi Aoife, thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm really thrilled to try the impossible in podcast terms, which is to talk about the visual arts without showing anyone any visuals, although there will be links in the show notes, but we will be trying to talk about these visual images through our words today.
I'm willing to give it a try. I think it's a good idea, a good departure.
Has to be done. It's such an important story in the tale of censorship and censure. It's just as important as the books or the film.
Well, I think so.
So we're going to start with a piece by Harry Clark, and it's called The Geneva Window. And can we just start off with a very brief description of what it looks like?
Quite a conventional window, an eight-paned window, because it was destined to go in quite a conventional window space, although now it's in a museum in Miami. But if you wanted to get a sense of what the window likes, if you weren't able to fly out to Miami to see it, you could visit the Hugh Lane Gallery and see the Eve of St. Agnes window, which was made just a few years before the Geneva window in the mid-1920s and was also made for an existing window space in a house in Balls Bridge. Or you could even look at the Bewley's windows to get some sort of a sense. But the Eve of St. Agnes in particular is very close to the Geneva window. And Harry Clark deliberately, based the decoration of the Geneva window on the Eve of St. Agnes. It's very, very sumptuously colored with a lot of blues and greens, but there's also purples and reds and orange tones within it. Decorated border around the edges of the window. And then Clark has used these kind of fronds of foliage to disguise where he has made, where he's connected the pieces of glass in each of the different sort of panes, if you like, in the eight panes, so that it's a sort of a kind of a sort of organic quality to the window. In the different panes, there are two scenes from literature, from early 20th century Irish literature. So they're mainly, they're figures that include scenes from the Playboy of the Western World, from James Stephen's Demigods, from Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Paycock, a poem by James Joyce, other scenes. And I suppose the other thing to note about the window, again, if you think of something like the Eve of St. Agnes or Harry Clark windows that you might be familiar with, is that the surface of the glass is very, very rich in texture. Clark double layered glass and he etched into the surface. So he drew into the surface of the glass to create very sort of, I suppose, complex and beautiful works, work of art. And then the other thing is that the lines of the texts, you know, that he's illustrating or that the window illustrates, they're also inscribed into the different parts of the window, you know, in connection with each of the different images or illustrations, if you want to see it like that.
So it's a piece of visual art that's very much referencing literary traditions in Ireland.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, Clark is known as an illustrator. He was in his lifetime known as much as an illustrator, as a stained glass artist. And he did do other windows which illustrated literature scenes in stained glass, like, for example, the Eve of St. Agnes, which illustrates Keats' poetry. He was very interested in Irish literature. He's particularly an admirer of the writings of John Millington Synge. He knew W.B. Yeats and George Russell, whose writings are also illustrated in the Geneva window. He was asked by the Irish government to design a window that was going to go into the International Labour Building in Geneva, which was a new headquarters for the International Labour Organization, which is still in existence. And Ireland joined it after it became independent in 1922. And in the mid-1920s, around 1925, they were completing this new building just on the lake in Geneva, and they invited all the member countries to contribute a work of art or a piece of decorative art, furnishings for the new building. And there was a lot of debate in the government at that time as to what they would choose for this. There were suggestions that maybe they would do Dunemer rugs, or there were inkwells as well, all kinds of things. The suggestion then came that, well, it would be good to put stained glass there because Ireland was very well known for its stained glass in the 1920s, and Harry Clark in particular was an internationally acclaimed artist. And they didn't run any proper competition for it, but Clark eventually got the commission, and he came up with this scheme to illustrate the writings of, I'm trying to remember how many different writers, 15. There's 15 different writers, most of them still alive at that. I think all of them were still alive at that point.
So out of those 15, I can't help but notice that there are a few who were extremely controversial and in some cases banned. Well, there was James Joyce, who isn't quite banned in Ireland, but is kept out. And then there is O'Flaherty, Liam O'Flaherty, who I've covered already in this season, and who himself in the 1930s claimed that he was sort of blacklisted personally, as well as professionally, a couple of his works were banned. Do you think that Clark's engagement with a controversial figure like O'Flaherty had something to do with the reaction to that work?
Oh, definitely. I definitely did. I mean, I suppose one thing to say about the window, when Clark came up with the list of writers, it was before the Censorship of Publications Bill had been passed. We would have come up with a list of writers in early 1927. He would have been working on it 1926, 1927. But he certainly included very controversial writers. I mean, another one was O'Casey, just before I get on to Liam O'Flaherty. O'Casey's Juno and the Paycock is illustrated within it. And the year after that, you know, there were the year after that had been put on in 1926, there were riots again with O'Casey. Liam O'Flaherty was specifically mentioned by the government and or by people who liaised between the government and Clark. Clark finished the window in 1930 and it was shown to the Executive Council, which is the kind of the cabinet in government buildings in Merrion Square in September of that year. Both William Cosgrave actually wrote to him directly and then Gordon Campbell, who liaised between the government and Clark. And they particularly pointed out Liam O'Flaherty. Now, the Liam O'Flaherty work that he chose to illustrate was a novel was published in 1926 called Mr. Galooly. It was never officially censored, but the image that he chooses to depict, Mr. Galooly is this kind of retired sort of civil servant, middle-aged, not particularly attractive individual who takes up and has a relationship with a younger woman called Nellie. And she is depicted basically doing a strip tease for Mr. Galooly in the window. He's sitting back in an armchair holding a glass of champagne and he's got a cigarette in his hand and he's kind of leering at her. And she is naked. She's got this beautiful sort of diaphanous scarf around her body, but we can see her breasts and most of her body through the through this kind of beautiful sort of shawl, for want of a better word, that she has around her. And that particular image, and the, but also I think the fact that it was associated with O'Flaherty was objected to at the time. And I'll just read out what Gordon Campbell said. He, as I said, liaised between the cabinet and Clark. And he wrote actually to Lennox Robinson so that Lennox Robinson could carry this information on to Clark. He said, since the window was begun, it's felt that Liam O'Flaherty's publications have taken a line that makes it difficult, if not impossible, for the present or any other Irish government to include a representation or illustration of them in a state gift to an international office. Finally, the government could not readily justify the inclusion under such circumstances of illustrations of an author such as, for instance, as Joyce, whose work has been brought under censorship by a government department. So they objected particularly to O'Flaherty, I think, because of this image. But they also mentioned Joyce, even though, in fact, Joyce's work wasn't subject, as you've said, to censorship. But it was particularly, I think, the representation of the nude figure in the work. The image of Nellie, the lover doing her striptease, is the part of the window is shared with an illustration of George Russell's Deirdre, which shows Deirdre and her lover, Nisha. And Deirdre is also wrapped in this kind of, again, another one of these beautiful diaphanous shawls. And we can see completely her body, her nude body. So there are several scenes of nudity in the window and of, yeah, sort of eroticism and, you know, references to sexuality, to lovers. There's also the scene of pegging Mike and Christy Mann in The Playboy of the Western World.
Yes, it's quite interesting how the O'Flaherty panel with the O'Flaherty and the Deirdre figures, how they really stand out when you look at the whole image because of the nudity. You know, it is the most nude panel in the whole piece, isn't it?
Absolutely. But I mean, as somebody would say, as Kenny Everett would say, it's all done in the best possible taste. They're beautiful images. I mean, and the poses of the figures. And one of the, you know, if you look at the overall image of the whole window, you'll see all these different poses of the figures, particularly many of the female figures in the middle two bands of the window. Clark was very interested in dance and interested in theatre. And one of the big sources for the figures, including that Nelly figure in the Mr. Galooly part of it, was the Ballet Russe, which he had seen in London and in Paris in the 1910s and the early 1920s. And he had, you know, magazines and programs and photographs. And Nicola Gordon-Bow, who was the great expert on Clark, actually traced that figure of Nelly to a photograph of a Ballet Russe dancer. So this was a company that the origins were Russian, but it was really based in Paris and France during the 1910s and 1920s, and put on these amazing, you know, ballets with music by Stravinsky and Debussy, contemporary composers. And their subject matter was often to do with eroticism. There was one actually all about masturbation and sexual attraction. And what was very innovative about it was the way that the bodies, poses of the figures, express these kind of ideas. But as I've said, in a very tasteful manner. So that, I think, for Clark, maybe made the window very sort of sophisticated. It fitted in with the kind of avant-garde, and it would have appealed to the kind of audience that would have seen it in Geneva. You know, it wouldn't have been the general public that would have seen this window. It would have been diplomats or people involved in, I suppose, the labor organizations, people, you know, of a kind of international background, and who would have perhaps been able to appreciate, if you like, the sort of references that he was making in the window.
And he makes this beautiful window and for the government to go in a very specific space in Geneva. But they never sent it to Geneva, did they? They backed out in the end. Why did they back out? Was it O'Flaherty, Joyce, Juno, even the Playboy? It was just too much?
Well, they never really gave a proper reason as to why they were rejecting it. Again, typical, let's say, of a lot of things in Irish political life. Clark was asked by William Cosgrave to replace, if he would consider replacing the O'Flaherty panel. And he said that he wouldn't do that. He didn't want to do that. But there was no proper negotiation. He was extremely ill. He had to go back to Switzerland to continue his treatment for TB. You know, he went at the end of September, October of 1930, and he waited for a response and kept writing back, and nothing was resolved. And he died without knowing what was going to happen to the window. And his widow, Margaret Clark, they paid for the window in early 1931, after Clark's death. She received the money for it, but she never received any explanation as to why they weren't going to put the window into Geneva. Looking at sort of memos from civil servants and letters of that time, the reason seemed to be that it was just considered, A, that it included the work of writers like Joyce and O'Flaherty that were now, well, O'Flaherty was one of the first writers to be banned, and Joyce was not considered to be suitable. Also that there were a number of images in it that were, you know, that were of a sexual nature. Other comments by one of the civil servants referred to the fact that it represented the Irish as kind of drunken types, because there are many, three of the male figures in it are shown drinking in it. So there's a bottle of Guinness in it to do with the O'Casey play. And Mr. Galooly, as I said, is quaffing champagne. And then there's another illustration at the bottom of it, which relates to Fitzmaurice's play, The Magic Glasses, which had been put on in the Abbey in the mid-1910s. But it shows a young man who's basically, it's about a young fellow who's locked himself in the attic and he's surrounded by gigantic glasses full of cavorting little nude figures. It seems to be like a teenager that's gone to the bad, and his parents are very concerned about him. So there's lots of the male figures in it are all kind of, a lot of them are kind of weak figures. They're, you know, they're seem to be in sexually obsessed, or else they're drunk. But the female figures in it are, by contrast, very strong, and it's dominated really by female figures. The top of the window has got St. Bridget and St. Joan. So there are religious parts of it as well, I should say. So it has a huge diversity that reflects the literature, but one could also say perhaps it reflects Irish culture and Irish life in good and bad forms.
It's amazing that they spent the money on it and they took it off the Clarks, but then did nothing with it. So what happened then? Didn't she buy it off them again?
She did. Now, the window had been put up by the Clark Studios in a room off in government buildings in Merrion Square beside where the cabinet met. And it was left there for about 4 years. And it was actually damaged during that time. I don't know what happened to it, but the studio had to repair a little bit. But I don't know, it was major damage, but it wasn't properly looked after. So Margaret Clark bought it back. She bought it back off the next government, the Fianna Fáil government, in around 1934 for the full sum that her husband had agreed for it. And she brought it. It was taken back and it was put in the Harry Clark Studios, which was in North Frederick Street. She continued the business, continued to produce stained glass windows for churches in Ireland and internationally right up into the 1970s. And Margaret Clark, she carried on that business. She was left in this position. So the window just remained there. She thought about exhibiting it in public in the 1930s. And she decided against that. I think there was a lot of concern that they didn't want the controversy to become public, because they didn't want it to negatively impact on the reputation of Harry Clark as an artist of religious work and his relationship with the church or the Harry Clark Studios, you know, the business that continued on after him. I think that was one of the reasons they hesitated. But later on, after Margaret Clark's death in the early 1960s, the window was put on display for quite a number of years in the Hugh Lane Gallery, where the more or less the same sort of area where the Eve of St. Agnes window is. As far as I know, I'm too young to remember it, but it was put on exhibition there from about 1963 up into the mid to late 1970s. And then there was some sort of falling out and the window was taken back by Clark's children, and they eventually sold it in 1988, and it was acquired by the Wolfsonian Museum in Miami, and that's where it is now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you point out that the Clark studio itself made no fuss and the government made no statement about it, so all of this happens behind the scenes. This is all very quiet. Do you think that the reticence to create a fuss is a feature of this sort of disagreements? And do you think that that's part of how censure works for visual art?
I think it is, yeah. I mean, particularly, I suppose, in the 1920s and the 1930s, there was, and also I should say, works that are commissioned in this way. So this isn't something that the artist just makes and exhibits and has some sort of control of. The fact that it was kind of commissioned means that the artist is sort of compromised as to how they can exhibit it and publicize it. And that gives a lot of power then, as I've said, to the people who commission it. So it might, in a way, differentiate a work of art from a piece of literature. You can't really exhibit it without the permission of the person who's commissioned it. It certainly is a way in which visual art is more susceptible to censorship, perhaps, than a work of literature, which can be circulated more easily through reproduction. I mean, now I know we think with the internet that art can very easily be reproduced, but it certainly wasn't easy to reproduce it back in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. And secondly, one would argue that seeing a work of art in reproduction is not the same as seeing it in the flesh. You're not really experiencing it in the way that it is designed to be experienced.
And so if we move then away from Harry Clarke and the silencing of his Geneva window, and we discuss the controversy that was a very public one and that was out in the open, and that's from 1942, the Georges Rouault's Christ and the Soldier, which was a painting that was exhibited and which did cause a lot of controversy and discussion and disagreement. This particular work, why did it provoke such a strong reaction?
Well, it's a religious subject matter. It's called Christ and the Soldier, and it's a little small gouache watercolor work. So it's not even an oil on canvas. The artist worked in this style. And I think it was really the representation of Christ that people found, or those that objected to it, found very, very difficult to accept. It was painted in a very modern, what was regarded as a blasphemous manner, a very, you know, Christ appears very kind of ugly and crude. There's a kind of a darkness to the subjects. Rouault is sort of specialised in the late 1920s and 1930s, in particular, in painting religious subjects from the Passion of Christ, and really going into, I suppose, the kind of the isolation, the loneliness of Christ. Christ as, I suppose Christ was a human figure, the human aspects of his suffering. Whereas critics like Kathleen Clarke, who saw the painting, was acquired by the Friends of the National Collections of Ireland in London in 1942. And they had been looking for work by Rouault because Rouault was a Catholic artist. He was still alive, didn't die till the 1950s. He was hugely admired by a lot of Irish artists and by, I suppose, Irish, without wanting to sound snobby about it, but Irish art, people were interested in modern art and Irish intellectuals, because he was a Catholic artist, as I've said, who was able to make this very interesting religious art. But the Friends wanted to give the painting to the Municipal Gallery of Modern Art, the Hugh Lane Gallery, which didn't have any acquisitions budget, so it was completely reliant on gifts. So they wanted to keep the collection, if you like, up to date with good works of modern international art. And so they offered the Rouault painting there. Now, when it was shown in the Municipal Gallery, it had to go to this kind of art advisory committee, which was made up of a mixture of artists and curators and members of Dublin Corporation. And a lot of the members of Dublin Corporation weren't particularly interested, or certainly not interested, in modern art or international modern art. And Kathleen Clarke, she was a former Lord Mayor. She was the widow of Tom Clarke, the man who was executed after 1916, leader of the 1916 Rising. She was very nationalist, and obviously I think must have been quite very religious. But she in particular was quoted as, you know, saying that this couldn't possibly go into a public gallery, that it was offensive to her, she said, as a Christian, to look at this type of imagery. that was the starting point of it. But the difference between it and the controversy over the Geneva window was, as you said, this became a public controversy. And the Friends of the National Collections, I'm not sure who did it, but I think somebody in the Friends must have leaked this story to the Irish Times, because a photograph of the painting appeared on the front page of the Irish Times in early October 1942. And it fed into a much wider debate that was going on about censorship at that time, during the later part of 1942. There had been the Taylor and Anstey, which you've covered in another one of your programmes, was banned. And there was a big public outcry over that, or an outcry, let's say, among the elite, perhaps more than the public. But it was being debated in the Senate in November, December of that year. And so censorship was very at the forefront, if you like, of the media and media concern, and particularly the Irish Times. And the Irish Times, I think, was also interested in highlighting anything to do with censorship, because it objected, or the editor Smiley objected, to the increased censorship that was being brought in because of the emergency, because of the Second World War. So there was literature, censorship of literature, but there was also this wider sort of political media censorship. And this seemed to be, I think, connected to that. And so that also meant that, if you like, there was more interest in this work of art and more interest in why there would be objections to it. Another aspect to it was that, unlike the Clark work, which was destined to go into this, building, this private building in a way, the Rouault painting was intended to go into a public gallery, so everybody can get in, can walk into the Municipal Gallery of Modern Art and see this work of art. And that was of concern, I think, to those members of the Art Advisory Committee who voted against it. It's this sort of protectionist, paternalistic attitude towards the general public, which is so much part of the whole censorship thing in Ireland at that time.
Yes, it's very similar to with the books that are censored. Often the more popular it is, there is an urge to censor because more people are reading it. And these people are indiscriminate readers who must be protected because they're too innocent and too stupid to know otherwise. And it's the same impulse.
Yeah. So I think that's, the Clark one was to represent Ireland internationally. So there was huge sensitivity about that. I might have made that clear earlier, but, that it represented Ireland as being not obsessed, but certainly very interested in sex and drink.
They
and
were
cavorting.
Right.
They were probably right, but we wouldn't want to admit it publicly. And I think Kathleen Clark's comments were genuine. She obviously did genuinely find this offensive, and she would have thought that maybe other Catholics who were used to seeing certain conventional representations of Christ would have found this deeply unsettling. And so they were making the decision, if you like, on behalf.
Yes, the conventional religious art, I suppose, that's found in churches and schools and convents, it's those alabaster saints kind of, everything is white or primary colours, and it's very, figurative. Yeah, whereas Rouault is a very different interpretation of, the human condition meeting the divine.
Very, very heavy black outlines. You can't really see the face of Christ at all. It shows his body kind of emaciated would be going too far, but it's not in any way an idealized body. If you think of those kind of Sacred Heart images that are kind of ubiquitous, yeah, it gives you, it also gives you a positive image of Christ. This is not in any way positive. It's more an iconic image to dwell on the what Christ was going through at that particular part of the Christian story. So it is actually quite a serious, it is a serious religious work, but that aspect was missed. And I mean, another part of the debate, just and the art world part of the debate really, was this resources thing. Why should we have international work coming into our gallery, especially the Municipal Gallery of Modern Art? It's the only modern art gallery in the country. We should have work by Irish artists. That really should be what's being prioritised. That was felt by some of the people who spoke out against it. And that's also that was also exacerbated by the war. A couple of speakers spoke out against this as being what one described as a continental red herring. you know, Europe is at war. It's the whole society is corrupt, and we don't. Why should we be part of this? Why should we have part of this in our public collections?
That was an element of neutrality, I think, that kind of holier than thou almost.
A smug attitude, really, that a lot of, you know, people like Beckett in particular later found very, very objectionable.
And so Kathleen Clark's reaction, it's very, you know, it's very instinctive and very emotional. You know, she uses the word offensive as well, which is really underpins a lot of censorship discussions, the concept of offence. And I often think that censorship and censure comes from that really kind of emotional reaction to art. Do you think that that's what critics are trying to articulate when they object to a piece, that kind of emotional response? Or are they perhaps drawing on more cerebral ideas about the representation of Ireland? Or
I think it depends on the critic. I mean, I think that a lot of the invective that was immediately published after the painting was, you know, shown to the Art Advisory Committee, and then they showed it in Dublin as well, in the College of Surgeons. I think that's an immediate reaction, and it is a kind of an emotional reaction, you know, genuine sense of fear, a sense of alienation from the culture that's producing this. And I think it comes also from a sense that modern art in particular is conning us. It's hoodwinking us. How do we evaluate something like this? It doesn't seem to have any great technical skill. It's not beautiful. It's not idealized. So it's that it doesn't fit in with an expectation of art that most people would have had up until well into the 20th century. And there was a fear of this kind of spread of this sort of modern art culture, you know, that it would, if we think back to conventional ideas, if we go back to this idea of the public gallery, there was the whole reason that public museums of art were set up in the 19th century, which was their kind of heyday, was art was seen to reflect kind of communal values and to instill a sort of sense of beauty and morality and order on society. So the lower classes were encouraged to go to museums and galleries in the 19th and early 20th century because it was felt it was going to have a beneficial effect on them. So it's a very Victorian idea about art that prevailed, as I've said, well into the 20th century. Now, modern art is completely different. It could be seen as it was seen, and a lot of it is very subversive. It's very individualistic. This is very much expresses Rouault's response. I wouldn't say this work is subversive, but I think it would have been seen, considered that way by people who weren't familiar with it. And it uses a very different type of formal language to sort of conventional academic art. It's very problematic. And if you're not familiar with it, then, as I said, that causes a genuine sense of fear and disgust. Also, I suppose I'd say in these decades, right up, you know, the 1920s and particularly the 1930s and 40s, there was widespread fear of the degeneration of public morals through the display of modern art in Europe. You know, if you think of the Nazis in the 1930s and the big exhibition of degenerate art, the Germans were the first really important collectors of modern art. They put it into their galleries before the French, even in the early 1900s, 1910s, 1920s, up until the rise of until Hitler came to power in 1933, they had amazing collections of modern art, and they took those all out rapidly in the mid-1930s, put them out of public view, they sold them off, they burnt part of them. So this idea of degeneracy was, I think it was a widespread fear. We can dismiss that, but I think that was a genuine fear about it. The other thing, of course, a lot of decisions was made by bureaucrats and politicians who do, I would say, particularly in Ireland, tend to be extremely cautious and conservative by nature, and who do not generally have any deep understanding or appreciation of visual art. And as I've said, they tend to take the paternalistic attitude, really.
That paternalism really does link ideas of reading and consumption of visual art. I mean, the kind of recreational improving value of reading was heavily stressed by librarians, that, you know, that you can educate the public if they read the right books. So we have to make sure they have the correct books to read. And therefore, we have a lot of nonfiction because that's very improving and will cultivate the mind more than reading, say, frivolous stories. And there seems to be a lot of interplay, I think, between what you're saying about visual art and the sort of things I've looked at for the censorship of the text. So do you think that there is a kind of a censure or censorship culture, like, that sort of blends from the text into the visual? Do you think that these two aspects are related?
I do, yeah. I mean, I think everything is interconnected. And I think if you are living in a society that has this very sort of censorious attitude, it's going to affect everybody, both the public and the producers of art. I mean, at a very basic level, I think that the culture of censorship in Ireland made access, although it was focused on films and publication, it made understanding of visual art elitist. In the same way, I suppose, that access to literature was, that you know, the only those whose families were involved in visual art or who came from sort of well-off backgrounds and could afford to travel and access education, where, you know, they would have learned art. Secondary schools didn't teach art, or primary schools, they dropped teaching of art in 1922. So visual art was definitely relegated to the sidelines, I think, in the early decades, for most of the decades of modern Ireland, right up into the 70s. To talk about the connection of, you know, with the censorship of publications and literature, yeah, the education of artists, the production, their relationship with their audience, if you like, with the viewers, yeah, it's subsumed into this wider climate of conservatism and prurience. You know, for example, regarding whether depiction even of religious subjects in this case, or regarding the depiction and understanding of sexuality, you know, where you're always looking for the dirty bits, as you're saying. I mean, that destroys your relationship with the visual image. And it also, I think, has a massive impact on this idea of individual, this need to conform that we find in terms of censorship. That makes it very difficult to understand what the modern artist is trying to do if you base your sense of culture on this notion of communal values. How does the artist fit into that?
I suppose also the censorship of publications really does focus very strongly on all the great modern writers. So modern literary forms come under great censorship. So the context is stripped out. If you get just the odd occasional visual piece from the modernist tradition, it might seem even more strange.
Yes, that's true. Yes, absolutely. I think that did contribute to a general ignorance and suspicion of modern art. I mean, you could argue that the production of art in Ireland was directly affected by censorship in the fact that many Irish artists tended to produce landscapes as opposed to nudes. Nudes are relatively rare in Irish art. And there's been what's been described as a very polite approach to modern art on the part of Irish artists up to the 1960s and beyond. And that could be seen as maybe an unconscious response to the society that they're exhibiting their work in. It could be also seen as a practical response that these artists, they need to sell their work. They alter it, they tailor it to suit a particular, a more conservative art going public and art market. And we don't get the same sense of an avant-garde that you'd find particularly on the continent, or particularly in Paris, where they just went mad attacking things all the time. It wouldn't have worked here. Our society was too small. And the other interesting thing about it is that it's sometimes argued that artists actually used sorts of strategies of censorship in their own work to imitate the mechanisms of censorship, again, perhaps unconsciously or deliberately in some cases. So like in Jack Yates's work from about 1926, 27 onwards, the late 1920s, when Censorship of Publications Act actually came into force, he moved away from very kind of realist work where you can really understand, everything's very legible, into his kind of later style where you get much more convoluted compositions and forms that are very, very difficult to decipher. And he also began to use much more enigmatic titles. So you get text becoming significant there. And his work entails the kind of direct physical involvement of the viewer. And sometimes it's not possible, actually, very often it's not possible to actually decipher every detail in his paintings, to know what exactly is going on. I've often thought, were these artists exhibiting this in a kind of playful way, you know, getting a joke out of it, or getting, what would you call it, a kind of a frisson or an added sense of meaning about the work, because it played on this idea of layers, of hidden layers of meaning, and of having to work round it to decipher it. It's, you know, I see it something as more than just a modernist thing, but a distinctly Irish thing. And the other thing I would say is that the fact that the government wasn't really that focused on visual art, you know, the emphasis was on literature. As I said, it was part of the relegation of visual art to the sidelines, but that could be liberating in a way. I mean, Harry Clarke, he didn't get away with it in the Geneva window. I think he thought he was going to get away with it. But in a lot of his church windows, there is something mildly subversive about them. The work that he was producing right through the 20s, you know, they celebrate modernity. You've got lovely young women in his windows, very fashionably dressed, very fashionable hairstyles, makeup. They're of the 20s. And I kind of think that's a little bit subversive. Some members of the clergy objected, you know, to his work on those kind of grounds. And there's a sensuality as well about his depictions of even the Virgin Mary, you know, that take delight in the intensity of the colour, the form, the sort of knowing expression of the figures that are subversive. And I'm sure that there were young women in particular, and men maybe, sitting in those masses endlessly in the 30s, 40s and 50s and looking up at those windows and getting what Clarke was getting at there, getting a kind of a release out into the contemporary world. I mean, he used film as well and popular culture as sources in these works.
Well, Róisín, thank you so much. That has been just an extraordinary tour through some of the big controversies in Irish art, although I know your book contains many more, so I would recommend people to go read. But it has been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it as well, actually. And thank you so much for inviting me to participate. So thank you very much.
Isn't it mad how forms of censure can be just as powerful as state censorship? Of course, it is harder to identify because there's no legislation and there's no register recording prohibitions. Sometimes I think we're more comfortable with the bureaucratic form of state censorship because it's easy to see. But censure can be so confusing. Who do you blame? Who's the baddie in these scenarios? Like, should we retrospectively cancel Kathleen Clarke because her religious feelings motivated her to prevent people seeing Rouault's painting? And how daring should art be anyway? Where is the line between challenging an audience and gratuitously offending them? It gets very complicated when the audience and the buyer are the nation state, as was the case for Clarke's Geneva window. Nellie's nakedness is artistic, but when the state paid for the work, it became a highly charged cultural statement. It implied really that they approved of such nudity. Now, Clarke wasn't selecting banned writers like Liam O'Flaherty deliberately, because, as Róisín says, there was no blacklist when he came up with the scheme for the window. But isn't it interesting that the plays and novels he chose pushed against safe, conventional taste? that old adage, all the best stuff was banned, sometimes looks true.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.